Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is Now or Never, and we just wrapped up the 13th Amendment, and we're actually, no, we didn't wrap up the 13th Amendment. We're going to dive into the 13th Amendment. My bad. We just wrapped up the preceding amendment, which was proposed by Thomas Jefferson. So to dive into that, and just to be quick through the obligatories, and actually I forgot to do this yesterday, we now have a pledge signed and done by Jerry Winstrand. And what we need you to do is we need you to come and check him out. He is running for auditor for the state of Missouri. So I got to add this to my obligatory because we need to get those who are fully supporting the Constitution into state offices, into all different offices. I am asking everybody who is, anybody that listens to this show and anybody who wants to support the Constitution, if you want to support a candidate that is absolutely committed to full support to the Constitution, demanding full compliance, then we need to support Jerry and whomever gets added to this. But we need to support Jerry. So whatever love you can throw to him, his links are on the candidate endorsement page on Reclaiming the Republic. So you can go see his website. You can go to his contributions. And by all means, send him some love, because he needs help in getting his message out, because he is fighting a party apparatus that has a stranglehold on the entire state of Missouri. With that, let's jump into the content. So we were just about to dive into the 13th Amendment, the original 13th Amendment. And oh, by the way, this original 13th Amendment was an original part of John Rowland's Constitution. In other words, he included these proposed amendments as a part of his Constitution for the Constitution Society. This is something that he did his own research on and found out that this actually was ratified. My, in doing research on this, also found that it supports this idea, this fact, that this amendment was actually passed, which means that we do need to go back to the records of Congress to go through this whole process, because I believe the evidence is there regarding the debates in Congress. Now, that doesn't mean that they haven't scrubbed the records, but they wouldn't scrub the debates themselves, because that's the day-to-day grind, that's the day-to-day matters that Congress takes on this, they take on this, and so I really doubt that they scrubbed that. They may scrub little parts where they may include the entire Constitution or what have you. Every once in a while, they'll do things like that. But all that being said, let's move forward in this 13th Amendment that was ratified in 1812. Now, Sean, I'll go ahead and let you, actually, who read last? Was it you, Sean, or Tammy?
I believe it was Tammy.
Oh, okay. So go ahead, Sean, and pick this up.
So, I'm sorry, which one did you say?
This is the 13th contested article proposed in 1810. Now, it's interesting, just as a side note while you're looking it up, it's interesting that they used in this Constitution the word article for each of the amendments. Technically, they did that for the Bill of Rights. I don't believe they did that for any other amendment. All other amendments down from the first 10 were actual amendments, like the 11th Amendment, the 12th Amendment, and so forth. They'd stopped using articles. So I believe John Rowland and the Constitution Society kind of clung to the usage of article, but technically, if the amendment went into Article 2, by calling it a different article would be kind of inaccurate. The best thing is that you'd refer to it as an amendment, not an article. But anyway, go ahead. Go ahead with the short 13th Amendment.
If any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility or honor, or shall, without the consent of Congress, accept and retain any present, pension, office, or emolument of any kind whatever from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them, or either of them.
Okay, so the history behind this was they started seeing lawyers and people coming in from Britain becoming citizens and maintaining their ties to the British bar. The British bar, the Bar Association, was considered a threat to America because it was the British accredited registry. And so, in other words, their loyalty was to Britain and the bar. The, in other words, this legal brotherhood. And so they saw this as a threat. Now, in the Constitution, there was this thing called the title of nobility in Article 4. But it didn't go far enough. They wanted to make sure that anybody that was wearing a title, such as Esquire, would be removed as a citizen and would no longer be able to vote, no longer be able to participate in the politics in America. Didn't mean that they would be deported. They could just no longer be a U.S. citizen and play within the political arena of the U.S. government, U.S. elections, so forth and so on. So, with that, any questions or comments? Tammy?
Wouldn't this mean that almost every single representative would not be eligible?
Well, so
don't all of them accept presents?
Yes.
Gifts?
Based on this amendment, many of the representatives in Congress and the state legislature and throughout the states, there are way too many lawyers in our government, way too many. And the entire court system has been absconded by the British bar. They created a money machine out of this. And that's why one of the reasons that they're open to jurisdiction over everything is because they make money. And by making money, by having more and more cases, they allow more lawyers to come into their courts to make money. This means that they created a large demand on more courtrooms and more court so that they could actually pay more lawyers to be involved in changing the law. I mean, how many times have you seen, you know, depicted in a television show or even in real life where you actually hear people talk about groundbreaking law, where they're trying a case to change law? The courts were never granted that authority to do that. But all lawyers, just by becoming a part of the system, get to play because they, unconstitutionally, they're getting away with changing the law. And the larger you make this apparatus, the more opportunities. It's just like the larger you make your election cycle, the more opportunities of election fraud. The larger you make your court system and access and all, you know, the participants that play, because you basically have, you know, the two sides of the lawyer, and that means you're just getting more money out to those people who are in your market space, and market space being, you know, the judiciary. So all of these people that have got their law degrees and they're part of the bar, they're being taken care of because the system is designed to help take care of everyone. Well, those who actually are willing to play the game. I've seen people become lawyers and pass the bar and then realize that it's just a corrupt machine and they end up, you know, not practicing law. Other than they'll go into a niche like estate law or something that's really innocuous to where they just, and they make a little living off of that, and then they probably do other things as well. And some of these guys will actually get into office so that they can, create law as well, legitimately as a legislator. But at this point in time, America saw the threat. And what ended up happening in 1812? Anybody understand the history? What happened in America in 1812?
I thought they just decided that they...
Okay, so...
I thought they just decided that we were struggling as a country and they were going to try to undo our independence by taking back over.
Well, so there's this little thing called the War of 1812. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, I live in New Orleans.
Okay, so who were the aggressors in 1812?
The British.
Huh. And, I would wonder, because I would look at the date of ratification of 1812, when this was ratified, and when Britain decided to attack. Does that make sense?
That makes sense, yeah.
Okay. So,
kind of like the Tory Acts.
Yeah, and so when we look at where the first attack was by Britain, where was that attack? In 1812, they attacked a very specific location in America. What was their first attack?
Was it Washington?
Yes, it was Washington, D.C., and they burnt it down. So, any records out there, they tried to destroy everything. Britain has always played, lately like they're our friends, but they've been self-serving the whole time. And so, anyway, this amendment was a legitimate amendment. It was legitimately passed. I can't believe the buzz, and they can't undo these hardcore books. In other words, these hard-printed books that believe it or not, Google is not our friend. And I would think that Google would eventually expunge these things. These images of what they did in capturing all of these documents. Because back then, they were part of capturing everything. And now they've given us enough, I'll just say, enough argument and support to our arguments of what has happened and what's been done. And now there's no doubt in my mind, Google's going to regret the fact that this is actually one of these things that they're giving us. They don't want to help us. They have no interest in saving America and saving the Constitution. They have their own plans, believe me. So as we go to the next one is an unratified article. This was proposed in 1861 by President Lincoln, just like the President Jefferson proposed amendment. So Tammy, go ahead and read this one.
Article 13, no amendment shall be made to the Constitution which will authorize or give to Congress the power to abolish or interfere within any state with the domestic institution thereof, including that of persons held to labor or service by the laws of said state.
Okay, so what was Lincoln proposing in this amendment?
Hands-off slavery.
There you go. In other words, he wanted to lock slavery down so it would be a protected institution, that no amendment. In other words, remember that amendment protection clause in Article 5 that made sure that no state could propose and get an amendment ratified, nor Congress could get an amendment ratified that would shut down the shutting down of the slave trade. That had to stay, just like...
Kind of reverse that.
Yeah, right, and so this is where he said, well, let's do that. And so what ended up happening, this was an olive branch to the southern states, and actually if you look at the date of when this went out, this actually went out before he was seated as president. In other words, there were already rumblings that Lincoln is going to take away slavery. As soon as he hits office, he's going to take away slavery. And so he sent out this amendment, as to Congress as well as to the southern states to say, hey, look, we want to guarantee you slavery.
But you think he did that knowing that he couldn't?
So, Lincoln, if you look at his life history, Lincoln was a man that was plagued with failure. He went into the U.S. Cavalry, the U.S. Army, as a captain. He was kicked out of the Army as a private.
Wow.
And,
that's hard to do.
Yeah, and so in 18 different situations, Lincoln was given, you know, a huge benefit, a win, something, and he failed. He had 18 hardcore failures with his life. He was not a rich man at all. Now, he may have had, I've heard people say that he comes from very rich blood, rich family. He was perceived as a dirt poor man that had nothing but failure. And that when he went into office, and this is my opinion based on everything that I know, and I know I get these nasty emails that, you know, Lincoln was corrupt from the beginning, he was all a part of this big plan, this big conspiracy, blah, 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 blah. I'm going to give you what I know, because this is academically what I can prove, that Lincoln was a failure. He was so desperate not to fail that he was doing anything and everything he could to not fail, because he was walking into office where the states were actually, the United States could actually cease to be.
Right.
For the guy that continually did everything he could not to fail, he kept on walking into failures. And I believe that was the divine hand of providence to harden this man to basically not accept anything but to do everything he could to actually fight this tearing apart of the Union. And it took him, because bottom line, there was only one thing that was going to stop the tearing apart of the Union. He had to end slavery. And he refused to end slavery. And so he said, well, okay, if you're going to secede, and I'm going to tell you that I'm not letting you secede, even though, you know, I'm completely an idiot regarding all of this, that, you know, I'm going to tell you you can't, and we're not going to let you. Well, the Constitution, the ratification debates, as well as, you know, the Federalist Papers and basic contract law, states that states can't, they assert that states can secede from the Union. If the federal government is violating the Constitution, and Madison covers this in other documents as well, so does Jefferson, you can nullify the law and secede from the Union. That is a fundamental tenet of contract law. That's exactly how they argued it as well. Therefore, when Lincoln saw all of this happening, he realized that he already began with failure. His only hope was to save the Union, in his mind, the only way he could. So it was basically to deny them that they couldn't leave. And then he, for 2 years of prosecuting a war against the South, he couldn't win a battle. In other words, God was giving him a message as he was killing more and more young boys from the North in his unconstitutional standing army. He was literally being humbled by the divine hand of providence, our Creator, in failure, failure, failure. You can't win a battle. Get right with me. And so Lincoln, this whole time, for 2 years, was taking flack from this guy named Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass said, you got to make it about slavery. You got to make it about slavery. And finally, when Lincoln basically was either going to have to concede, throw in the towel, or he had to change the motive or the drive for the war. And so he prostrated himself, and he ended up actually changing his position that it's not about whether you can secede or not. We're ending slavery. And that was the proclamation, or the Emancipation Proclamation, that he wrote 60 years ago, blah, blah, blah. And so that began the new tone, and that offered then the new amendment, which is what we actually have as the legitimate, or not legitimate, as we have as the second 13th Amendment. So we got 13th Amendment A and 13th Amendment B. This is 13th Amendment B because that original 13th Amendment stands still. Even though they say it's not there, they have to do far better than that. They're just saying that it never was. But unfortunately, it was because it was in all these other artifacts. So anyway, who's next? Is it Tammy? Tammy, are you up? I think Tammy, right? Yeah, so you've got the 13th Amendment right here. Go ahead and read the actual 13th Amendment regarding slavery.
Okay. Either slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction.
Okay. Section 2. Go ahead.
Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation.
Ah, now see, folks, this is the first time that that line shows up. This is the first time. But technically, what they just stated was the same thing that's in Article 1, Section 8. Basically, Congress shall have the power to make all laws necessary and proper to execute the aforegoing laws. That's all they were literally saying right here. They didn't, this did not give them authorization to go create their own enforcement agency. Okay, so bottom line, this amendment was put out and ratified by the northern states. And did they get the southern states to actually ratify it? No. So it was ratified by the northern states, I'm pretty sure. I mean, if you want to look this up in Wikipedia, I'm pretty sure that none of the southern states voted for it, and I'm pretty sure that they didn't count the southern states in passing it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what Lincoln did was he did a, what do you call that, a sleight of hand. You can't leave the Union, but we're passing an amendment and you have no opportunity to ratify it because you're not in the Union. Do you see what he did?
Right.
Okay. In other words, he literally played two sides and nobody caught him on that. And still to this day, I deal with people that say, hey, they never left the Union. Well, as far as Lincoln was concerned with the 13th Amendment, they did.
Yeah, we had that conversation on one of our calls.
Yes, we did. And actually, we actually prove that with the 14th Amendment and what Congress was doing, Congress was basically saying, you can't just walk into the Union. You left, and now you have to be readmitted. We will not admit you until either you ratify this amendment, or once we have it ratified, you will then will admit you once certain parameters have been met. They still held them accountable. Anyway, so
I don't see a problem with that. I don't understand why anybody, it just, the argument doesn't make sense that, oh, they weren't allowed to leave the Union, so they weren't, and then they didn't ratify this amendment because they were still in the Union. Well, if, how can you still be in the Union if you secede and then have a war with the Union? Mm-hmm. How are you still part of the Union?
Well, so it was the Union that actually went after them. How could the Union attack these states? Oh, well, they were insurrection. Well, what was the insurrection? It's not like they were attacking and burning any of these states. It was the most passive insurrection ever. Because the southern states did nothing other than leave the Union.
Yeah. It's
ergo,
like, we're done with y'all, we're leaving. And they said, no, you're not.
So, right, so the hypocrisy is just overwhelming, and it just it boggles my mind. And so we're going into break. So when we come back from break, we will actually cover the flip side into the 14th Amendment. And so this will help everybody, I believe, kind of understand the root, because I know Sean was involved in a couple of these phone calls, at least one of them, really exposed the person who was really against the 14th Amendment. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. So, okay. So, Sean, I know that you were on a call with me when a gentleman started speaking out regarding the 14th Amendment. And this kind of, it was very exposing because what it ended up happening, and I believe, tell me if I'm wrong, that it ended up leading into a very racist or racial, you know, position that this guy was taking.
Right. That's what it boiled down to when he realized that the argument that he was making didn't make any sense. He went back even further and said, well, you know, this country was only supposed to be founded for white people.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, there you go.
There it is right there.
There it is.
And that is so common. I mean, I've been dressed down by 14th Amendment advocates that, you know, when they can't actually prove that the 14th Amendment was not legitimately ratified, and they end up having to, you know, either eat the, you know, eat their words, or what they end up doing, instead, because pride is behind all of this, and what they end up doing is they basically start saying, look, this country was founded, you know, God founded this nation for white people. And I'm going,
that is the craziest thing I think I've ever heard.
Yeah, I know. So, folks, this is what we get to deal with in the cause of liberty. And so, right, wrong, or indifferent, these people exist. Right, wrong, or indifferent, this is something that we have to deal with. And if you get involved in this, you'll deal with it too. Unfortunately, it's not about whether we're willing to live with our brothers and sisters. It really is, you know, whether we have control or they have control. That's how these people think. And I can't believe that anybody would think that we're not all God's children, but people actually, you know, think otherwise. So anyway, that being said, let's dive into the 14th Amendment. And so this is probably one of the best. This amendment, it was the final keystone to create this true protection of liberty for the people that lived in America. And so, Tammy, you just read, so I think it's Sean's turn to read Section 1, right?
I will gladly and proudly.
Okay, great.
Article 14, Section 1. Sean,
excuse me. So let's break this down by the different clauses. So there's the citizen clause, and then the privileges and immunities clause, and then the other two clauses. So let's do it that way. So go ahead.
All right. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside.
Okay, so the key word which you did a very good job in emphasizing is subject to the jurisdiction thereof. When you read that language, you can clearly see that this is dealing with specific people living in the United States who are subject to the jurisdiction. A person that walks across the border of the United States is still under the jurisdiction of the state or the nation they came from. And until they formally go through the process of becoming an immigrant, they're still on the hook of being a citizen of that other state. So in other words, the fact that they bypass the port of entry, the proper port of entry, to say, I want to become a citizen of the United States, and they wanted to overrun our laws and invade us, whether it be a family or whether it be one person, it doesn't matter. There have been millions of people on our southern border that have all basically, coincidentally, or through some mode of organization, been compelling them and driving them to come here to basically destroy us. Madison stated this in the ratification debates, that if we allowed an invasion, ultimately they would destroy us. They would take over our government. And he's not talking about a combating force. He's not talking about a military force. He's talking about any kind of invasion. Because these men knew the petition 3, we identify the doctrine. I think it's the Hadith or something like that. No, it's not the Hadith. I'll open it up when you read the next part, and I'll tell you what the doctrine is. But this is a doctrine practiced by Mohammedans of literally migrating, or actually invading, going across the boundaries and actually just getting themselves into a nation so that they can sit there and populate and populate and get more migrants. They call themselves migrants, but they're not immigrants. They're migrating across the border. And they go, oh, well, it's like ducks. They migrate, right? Are they a citizen of North America or South America? And I think you get my point. This is a migration that is designed for a cultural takeover, because that's exactly what they're told to do in their doctrine, is to, you know, get mass and mass and mass people. And they did this to Iran. And I point this out in petition 3, that they actually migrated into Persia, which was ancient Iran, and they literally overtook them and basically forced them into Islam, and they destroyed the Zoroastrian faith of the Persians. Now, not that I'm a fan of the Zoroastrian faith. The point is that this is a doctrine that is designed to sneak into your land and amass and amass and amass to a point where they can take over. And the fact that there are places in the United States that is allowing Sharia law and supporting these types of things, every person, every politician that's allowing this to happen, and every person that is not actually seizing these insurgents, seizing these combatants in America and not deporting them forthwith, they're complicit in allowing the destruction of America. They're failing to fulfill their oath of office. And I could just go on and on and on. But like I said, I will look this up while Sean reads, these next parts of Section 1. So let's dive into that next part, the Privileges and Immunities Clause.
Before we do, you're speaking of Hijra.
Hijra, thank you. Yes, sir. That's the doctrine. That's what I was going to go look up. It's in Petition 3. And yes, correct. So, folks, they actually have a name for it. And the framers knew this, and this is why they included the term invasion, not a military attack.
Right.
Okay. Go ahead.
All right. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive
Hold on, that's right there.
Okay, yeah.
Stop right there. So that's the first one, the Privileges and Immunities Clause. So what did that just happen? What did they just do in that? What they did was they applied all protections guaranteed by the Constitution. Now, when you talk about protections guaranteed by the Constitution, does that include amendments?
Yes.
Okay. It boggles my mind how many people say, oh, that doesn't include the Bill of Rights. It only includes the Comity Clause.
Right.
And the Comity Clause is in Article 4, and it's basically reciprocity. But no, this is actually applying a level of restrictions upon the states that they cannot make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen, which means that our right to petition, our right to freedom of expression, our right of being secure in our persons, the states cannot make or enforce any law that denies us these privileges and immunities. And they're doing it. But go ahead with the next one now.
Before we do, so who has jurisdiction over this statement to hold the states accountable to not in making or enforcing any law which shall abridge the privileges and immunities?
It means, so it's rising under this Constitution, right? So if a state does make a law that abridges the privileges and immunities, that means that the federal government would have jurisdiction over it. But what would have to happen would be the case would actually be brought up to the state court and say, you just created a law that's abridging my privileges and immunities that's guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution.
Right.
Now, you don't have to go to court, by the way. You can actually petition your government by actually for a redress of grievances by going to your legislature. And by using that First Amendment petition, if they pass on that, you can then petition the Supreme Court.
Right. That's what I was getting to. So it would be the Supreme Court that would hold jurisdiction over that.
Well, either that or Congress. I mean, a person, you can actually petition anybody in government, but technically we are to petition our representatives. So it would be my inclination, because if you do petition the Supreme Court, what's going to happen?
They're going to throw it out.
No, they're going to ask you for money.
Oh.
So if you don't have deep pockets and you don't want to go down that path, then you just petition Congress. Or actually, yeah, you petition your state legislature, then you petition Congress.
How can they get away with that? I mean, that is ridiculous. That act right there would be doing the same thing. You say, oh, because you're poor, I'm allowed to, rain tyranny on you because you don't have the money to take me to court?
Yeah, that's right. That is right. Now, if you committed a crime, we will defend you, but you can't fight for justice. And that right there is the whole point of the First Amendment and the right of petition.
Right.
It cannot be a bridge that every person can petition their government. In other words, their representatives for redress. Now, Tammy's on this, and Tammy's probably aware of this. Actually, I know she is. That in Hot Springs, Wyoming, that's a county in Wyoming, where a judge basically was petitioned by a person to have his property reassessed at a different tax rate or whatever. I don't know the ins and outs, but the judge basically denied this guy this tax relief by trying to reassess it. And so the judge denied it and said, you got to pay the taxes. Well, this person, not accepting that, basically went to his county commissioners and he petitioned them. And basically, if you look at that act of petitioning them, he was asking them for redress. The question is, in our Republican form of government, do not our representatives have the power to actually provide relief, to provide redress? And yes, they do. This court judge is very pissed off, and he's actually going after these county commissioners for exercising their privileges and their right for redressing a citizen of their county's petition.
Yeah, unfortunately, these two county commissioners understand that they do have the jurisdiction to do that. So,
yes. And so the judge is fit to be tied. And as a matter of fact, this is not just the only case that's going on. In one in Hot Springs, and the focus right now, we've actually got a good light in Wyoming. And because of Petition 8, folks, we have a great light that actually is like a heat-seeking missile or a laser-guided munition in some form of going after the judiciary for actually taking and seizing control of our justice system. And so bottom line, they're doing everything they can to maintain and protect their control and aggrandize their control. And there's judges. This literally was stated in another court in Hot Springs, where a judge said all statutes in the state of Wyoming that are part of the state laws, all statutes within the state of Wyoming are constitutional. I was told this, and I said, hold on here. Do you have a minimum wage law in the state of Wyoming? And the individual told me, yes, we do. And I go, interesting, because I've looked at the Wyoming Constitution, and the people, the good people of Wyoming, did not delegate to their government the ability to regulate the wages of labor or even get involved in regulating labor. That power's not been delegated. And yet they've created a minimum wage. So let's look at this deeper, because maybe this regulation came from the federal government. So let's look at the federal constitution. Did the good people of America grant the federal government the ability to regulate labor in any manner or form?
No.
That's correct.
No.
Now, actually, if you look down in this constitution, we will find down in, which one is it? I think it is article, so it's an unratified article. It's on page 19. This was proposed in 1926, where the President of the United States, Calvin Coolidge, championed and basically pursued an amendment through Congress to take to the states and tried to champion it to America, to allow the United States government the ability and power to regulate and prohibit certain labor of children. What I just said is that they didn't have the amendment. They sought it, and it was never ratified. And yet they continue to regulate our labor. And so the folks, now that we actually have clearly no authority from the federal government to basically push this regulation of minimum wage upon states, and now we found states have actually crossed the line and imposed unconstitutional minimum wages, and yet that's a statute in the state of Wyoming, and a judge is going to tell me it's constitutional. So the night is day, and day is night. Good is evil, and evil is good. That's what the judge wants us all to believe. And so we don't live in bizarro world. We live in a constitutional republic where the Constitution actually sets the limits of our government. And if it's going out beyond those limits, then it is whose job to hold government accountable and get them back into the bottle, get them back into check and living within those limits? Whose responsibility is it?
The people.
It starts with you, folks. That's right. And then we go to our legislators at the county level, the state level, and up. So, excellent. All right, so back to the 14th Amendment. And let's go ahead and look into the details of the next one, because we just covered the privileges and immunities. This next one is what?
Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law.
Okay, so hold on here. Go to the, let me see here. I'm going to find it. I think it is the Fifth Amendment. Yes, so I'm going to read this out of the Fifth Amendment. Where it basically says, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without the due process of law. So why, if that statement is already protect U.S. citizens in the Fifth Amendment, have that as protection and privilege and immunity, why did they have to repost that into the 14th Amendment? Any ideas?
No.
I don't either. I could only guess as to why, but maybe they just felt that they needed to emphasize it more to make sure that the southern states got the message that this is including that. But to me, it sends a mixed message because if you're actually adding or duplicating something that you've just in the previous clause said, all privileges and immunities afforded to a U.S. citizen cannot be denied by the state, nor can the state make a law or enforce a law to deny them of that. So it just doesn't make sense why they did that, other than the fact that I think it's kind of like, you know, the protection of speech, religion, the press, all kind of the same thing, of expression. It's all a protection of expression. Anyway, so the next one, go ahead, is the very last part.
Nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws.
Okay, so that right there is new. And that right there is literally laying out that if a person, any citizen, walks into a restaurant, a public operated business, so that any citizen can walk in there as a patron and seek service, they have a right to sit anywhere in that restaurant. If that restaurant creates a rule or creates a law that says you can't sit in these seats, you have to sit in those seats, then that is not equal protection under the law. Everybody has a right to sit in all seats available to the public. If you're a part of the public, you have a right to sit there. Do you see what this is saying here? What this means by equal protection under the law. This basically was attacked in Plessy v. Ferguson with being redefined by the court in stating separate but equal. They basically said what that means is separate but equal. No. That is very clear that all people have the equal right to access all things that are available to anyone. If it's available to one, it's available to all in a public forum. Now, you can have a club, and your club can only serve those people you want to serve. That's fine. That means it's not open to the public. But if you are open to the public, you're open business to the public, you can't create these segregation rules, because they knew that that's what the South would do. And yet the court basically slapped these good men that created these protections for these freedmen who knew they were going to be persecuted and oppressed. Well, the courts actually just once again sent America back another century, back into the segregation and basically being able to oppress one race over another. So,
does that just apply to race, or would it apply to, like, people living in or in the United States who are not citizens?
It applies to citizens.
It says, nor deny to any person
right
within its jurisdiction.
So it is citizen, because a citizen has a right of due process. A citizen has, up above, the citizen is the one that has the privileges and immunities of the laws of the Constitution. The Constitution does not protect citizens who are not under its jurisdiction. It would almost basically state that if the Constitution protects...
You can be a citizen and not be under the jurisdiction.
So you can be
if you're a citizen, you're under jurisdiction, right?
No. Back in those days, you did not have to be a citizen of the United States. You could be a citizen of the state. The only thing is you can't vote. You have no ability to vote. You can't travel abroad because you'd need a passport. By that point in time, they started managing people traveling abroad and so forth. And so you had to be a citizen to travel abroad. If you did, you left, you better be able to prove that you actually had a right here. You know what I'm saying?
But it says that all persons, and then it describes them, are citizens.
Okay.
All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens and citizens of the state. So then it comes down to the bottom and it says person.
Don't jump over the next part. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges and immunities of
the citizens
of the United States.
Right.
Okay. That means that the constitutional laws were extended to you know, everybody within the union, every all so citizens.
Citizenship.
So they had to be citizens, and at this point in time, that first clause made all Indians and all freemen, former slaves, they were all instantly granted citizenship.
What about Lakota Nation?
What's
they
that?
Have their own nation. Are they citizens?
So
they
who,
don't pay
who,
taxes.
Who's Lakota? Is that somewhere in...
That's North Dakota and South Dakota. They have the nation.
Okay, so in the North...
In the United States territory.
That's an easy question to answer. They were in what territory? The Canada territory or...
No. In North Dakota, now, right now, today, they have Lakota Nation that is its own entity.
Okay,
within
so
the United States boundaries.
Were they imported? Did the federal government import these people, like the Mohammedans that they put in Michigan and so forth, and who have been creating these states of Sharia law? Are these Lakota people?
No. What I'm asking is about. Are they citizens? Did the 14th Amendment make these Native Americans
citizens?
To
answer that question, was the Lakota tribe in the Dakotas when the 14th Amendment was ratified?
I believe so, yeah.
Then they are citizens. Yes.
Okay.
Now, when you look at the citizenship, the oath of citizenship, can you be a citizen of another state or another nation?
No. Well, another state, but no, not to be a citizen of the state. You're a citizen of one state,
technically, we're talking about foreign states, foreign nations.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I would say
so. When you look at the oath of a citizen, you have to abjure all allegiance to foreign states. Technically, when you look at the Indian tribes, they didn't have this allegiance of a government. And it was a culture. It was, you know, a fundamental body of collective people living together, and they had kind of like their own code and so forth. But they weren't established as actual, like, nations as we look at it today, because many of them were nomadic. They moved from here to there. They didn't have any land. They didn't recognize land as something that would be owned. They were more of an ideal.
If you're not a citizen.
Yeah.
So if you're not a citizen of the United States, then your jurisdiction, you're under the jurisdiction of the country that you came from.
That is correct.
Correct.
That is correct. But if you lived in the United States and were under the jurisdiction of the United States, then you have become a citizen, whether you liked it or not. We just literally ran out of time. So technically, whether they liked it or not, they actually became citizens. And the real question is, did the United States go out of its way? Did the United States go out of its way to create dual citizenships with the Indian nations? Or did they actually basically say, we recognize their culture as a unique culture within the United States, like Irish, what have you, but they're not necessarily nations? And so they were cultures, religions, beliefs. They had ideologies, rules. And G.R. Mobley, we're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.